Hey guys,
welcome back.
Good to see you guys.
We were just having a little interesting off-mic conversation about the time, quote, Steve almost killed himself.
Yes.
Which
accidentally.
It was accidentally.
No self-harm.
No self-harm as a triathlete. Well, but I guess my first question to you guys is, when are we going to swim the bay?
Well, we've got the three of us.
Yeah.
So we could each pick up one sport. I think Trump is doing some stuff with the bay and Alcatraz and swimming.
Oh, I heard that's right? Coming back.
Yeah. So,
but thousands of swimmers.
Thousands of people do this.
Yeah. It's quite easy. Like if I'm in prison and just shave,
Ben Kelly.
Yeah, it's not a challenge.
It's not like what it used to be.
I think we should start Alcatraz. With just swimming the buoy lot.
Make Alcatraz scary again.
I'm already scared. I mean, even though people do it every year, the fact there was a great white that bit a seal or ate a seal like 10 years ago. Oh, yeah.
It was captured on video.
Yeah.
It was like the first one.
I didn't see this.
It was the first one that entered the bay that was captured on video before.
One year
usually don't enter the bay.
Jen's birthday, we had a friend paddle from the clubs, paddle us out there, dropped there maybe four or five of us that swam.
Yeah.
And he escorted us in on one of those rowboats.
Oh, yeah.
And we swam, we climbed down the rock and then swam right in. It's totally fine. No, no bites.
Yeah. But the video, have you seen the video, Max?
No.
Oh, it's wild because, I mean, there's a bunch of tourists.
You may not want to.
A bunch of tourists were going to Alcatraz, right? And then one of them captured this, but it just, there's a lot of blood in the water.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So while I deeply respect and admire the ability that you're able to do that swim, I'm going to stick in the cove. But we should all do a cove swim at some point.
All right, we'll do that.
Nice chill.
Let's do it. So. Okay, so speaking of blood in the water.
Yes.
Huh? How do you like that?
you can tell DK's been practicing that one for the last week.
Speaking of blood in the water, Knots is killing Bitcoin Core from what I hear. Is it
growing market share?
7% according to Clark Moody's charts.
I saw people saying 8.
Okay.
Wow. Okay, so that's up from, you said 2% last week. No?
What does
this mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
So Steve, you've been doing some
studying.
What
do you guys think? Are you scared?
Well,
Is it good? Is this healthy?
I don't have any real perspective of, is it good? Is it bad? Like on the surface, I'm kind of like, okay, like more different implementations that people are choosing to adopt seems like a good thing rather than have everybody on a single implementation. Like let decentralization win, let people try different things and choose different things and kind of vote with their feet and economic ability how they want.
But one concern I would have, high level, I agree with DK, and that's like my sort of biased. However, I also understand that if you go in too far of different directions, that also potentially could split the protocol in the future. So I'd love to obviously hear your thoughts on this. You've thought more deeply, but maybe you could also, in framing it, help us think about it by comparing to the Lightning Network, which does have different implementations. Yeah, at least so far, that's not been a concern.
That's good. Well, and there's trade-offs. So I can speak to both. My take on multiple implementations of the Bitcoin protocol, at a high level, I agree. It's good. I mean, what I feel very strongly about is having that option is essential to Bitcoin's health. Now, in practice, do we need it? Like some people, I think, feel like we are at great risk if there's one dominant implementation, which is the case that it's always been that case on Bitcoin. I disagree with that. I don't think it's ever been a problem. I don't think it's a problem right now. And I'm not worried about it in the future. So if 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now, it's still just the Bitcoin Core project and whoever the maintainers and contributors are, we can have a very vibrant, healthy, decentralized Bitcoin. I feel very strongly about that. I think other people maybe disagree, but I feel like that's a winnable argument.
That seems to be the case as long as people don't have like a lot of different opinions they want to express, right? If people are kind of like, yeah, Bitcoin kind of is what it is and should work kind of how everybody kind of agrees it should work, then we can all just use Core and that's fine. And if you ever do decide to change, you can still split off and do your own version, right? So it doesn't need to be that a lot of different people use a lot more than Core. It needs to be that you can have Core and you can always take it in a different direction if you want. And if enough people come on board your new direction, then that's Bitcoin.
The reason I think it's not a problem today and probably won't be a problem in the future is because if you look at the history of the project and the contributors, it's a fallacy to think that it's centralized or that like five people control Bitcoin
who right.
have the power to push a button and merge a commit. That's just a fallacy. There's a really good post by BitMEX research and another one by Jamison Lopp. We can link them in the show notes I tweeted them out recently as well, that cover this extensively and I think make really solid arguments. And so, I think the only, and I'd also say the Bitcoin Core project has set a really high bar in terms of attention to detail, attention to security, privacy, decentralization, relatively conservative mode of operation, very deliberate in their changes. And they have that track record for that project for over a decade. So I just don't see like some massive reason to switch. Also, a point we should talk about is like who are the different types of users of Bitcoin Core? Mm. And some users are Bitcoin, enthusiasts. Like some of the people on Bitcoin Twitter, they love Bitcoin. They're passionate about it, and they might run Bitcoin Core. We'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a second. But there's also businesses like Coinbase or Block or Kraken, different exchanges and stuff.
Or miners.
And the miners, very different groups. I think if you're a business handling millions of dollars or receiving like millions of dollars of Bitcoin a day or like fairly regularly or whatever, what you care about most is security, making sure that the coins are being validated correctly. So you're not, selfish reasons, so you're not getting screwed. And then secondarily, you care about general health of the network. I mean, you don't want Bitcoin like destroyed or something, or else it screws with your business. But I think that it like relay policy and ideological stuff is less of a priority for businesses. So anyway, let's get back to Knott's, like Knott's taking market share. What does that even mean? Does it matter?
What is Knott's? Has it been around forever, or is it kind of a newer thing? Or
it's kind of an alternative implementation to Bitcoin. It's a fork of Bitcoin Core, the software. And Luke Dash Jr. is the primary or the only maintainer and the primary contributor to it. And he also contributes to Bitcoin Core and knows Bitcoin Core really well. He keeps Knott's up to date with Bitcoin Core. So it's basically Bitcoin Core plus some other changes, which are largely like Luke's personal views on what's important. I think he's made some changes in the past that accommodated miners more. And then he obviously is very opinionated about consensus and relay or policy and just other aspects of Bitcoin. He expresses those views through code in Knott's. So that's what Knott's is. It contrasts that with other alternative implementations of Bitcoin, which are complete rewrites, like in different languages. Like there's a BTCD is written in the Go language.
Is that still maintained?
I think Lalu in his spare time. I know Calvin Kim has spent some time maintaining it, and maybe a few other developers, but pretty small developer base supporting that. There's LibBitcoin, which is another C or C++ implementation that Eric Boskal has maintained for, I think Amir started it long ago.
Yeah,
Eric Boskal, I think, has spent eight or more years maintaining it. And there's a few other contributors. Holpreet Singh, who's actually been working on quite a few mining protocol projects recently, he's also contributed to it. So there's that project. And there's a JavaScript one, Bitcoin.js.
Yeah.
That was written by a developer from, forgetting the name now.
Decred project, no? Didn't they? I think they.
That was BTCD.
Oh, that was D. Okay.
Decred guy, developers did BTCD.
Got it.
And then Lalu like took over. Purse.io.
Purse. Yeah, right.
One of the developers behind Purse, I think, wrote Bitcoin implementation in Bitcoin.js. But none of these implementations have any or like a minuscule amount of market share.
And in each one of these implementations, you could use that to run a full node and to run mining software. Is that all kind of in each one of these versions?
Yes. I don't know for these other implementations how much they optimize for miners or not. So
focused on kind of full node.
But you can run them as a full node. I think BitMEX Research set up a project where they ran several of these implementations, or they're running several of these implementations in parallel and always compare the block to make sure that they remain in consensus. Because one of the risks with multiple implementations is that they get out of consensus with each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
So even if it's well-intentioned and there's reasons for it to be healthy to have multiple implementations, a disaster scenario is for two implementations to disagree on consensus and it forks the network. Now, if it's just some hobbyists running on a Raspberry Pi, some other implementation, and they're not even receiving money on that node, then it being forked off is like inconsequential
right.
to them or to anyone. If it's the case where half the network is running one version and half the network is running another version and sort of equal amount of economic nodes on both sides, and then there's a consensus conflict, that's a disaster because it'd be a fork and then it'd be a total mess
right.
to clean the, to either like, I mean, literally it would have to be social consensus to like wind things back and get back on consensus if it was sort of unintentional, which is probably what would happen, but it's super messy.
Yeah.
Or if that doesn't happen and then there's two versions of Bitcoin.
So one question on this without following super closely. So last week you mentioned Bitcoin Core, like 98-99%. Sounds like Knots is picking up heavy steam from the people that are, you know, sort of in support of monetary data only, whatever that actually means. How close are we now? And I'm not trying to be controversial. It's like an honest question to like this leading to a hard fork. Like how quickly could this spin into differences in opinion on consensus? Or is that not on the table at all?
Well, it's not on the table unless it's an unintentional hard fork.
Okay.
Because Knots is Core with some deviations. But as far as I know, Luke hasn't changed consensus rules in Knots. That's not his, he's never stated that as a goal.
Right.
So it would only be unintentional. And the risk of unintentional with Knots is the lowest of any of these other implementations because it's a copy of Core, a fork of Core with some deviations.
Where, you know, the deviations all due to the up return stuff that's in the recent drama?
I mean, he's done Knots for like at least 8 years.
But I mean, like the reason we're talking about today, the reason it's got 7%.
We're talking about today because like it is gaining in market share. Yeah. I mean, there's the drama we talked about last week. Knots is gaining in market share. So like why and does that matter? Is it good or bad for Bitcoin? Like those are the questions we want to tackle right now.
Yeah.
And then I'd love to also talk about like the, you know, what's even the purpose of running a full node? I think everyone in Bitcoin has heard running a full node. Like everyone should run a full node. It matters.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of nuance to it. So, you know, let's go through that as well. But yeah, as far as not gaining market share, I mean, the TLDR for me, like, I don't think it really matters. Except for signaling dissatisfaction by a set of Bitcoiners.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it matters in the sense, I'm assuming most of these nodes that came online or either switched to Knots or came online in the past week or so, are hobbyists, enthusiasts, people who aren't running a business and receiving a bunch of Bitcoin on these nodes. I just assume, you know, someone jokingly tweeted that, you know, I'm running my four Knots nodes on AWS or whatever, right? I mean, you can Sybil attack that metric.
Yeah.
The number of nodes running the network, the percentage running Knots, you can Sybil attack that. Like after the show, we could go up and spin up 1,000 Knots nodes and make an enormous difference on that metric. And that's inconsequential to the Bitcoin network functioning. It's inconsequential to any future like relaying of op returns that are over 80 bytes.
Right.
It's inconsequential to consensus. So that's why I say it's inconsequential. And I mean, another question to ask is like, oh, is this is this the end of Bitcoin Core? Like, or like, are people going to switch from Core to Knots and like that project no longer matters, whatever. I mean, there shouldn't be arrogance around this. Like if there's genuine dissatisfaction with Core, I mean, like we can think of reasons why people would genuinely be dissatisfied with Core. Let's say that they had a series of security issues.
Right.
And the current Core contributors were just messing up over and over and over again with security. I'm running a business, I would be asking questions.
Yeah.
And I'd be looking into like, let's fund another project. Let's fund other developers and not just like say we want to run another implementation, but actually put your money where your mouth is and fund developers to do another implementation. So that's why it's important to have that option. But that's not the case. The controversy right now is around this relay policy, which people have already heard my opinion. We talked about it on the show last week, but in my opinion, that's not a reason for businesses to switch or individuals to switch from core to a different implementation. And certainly a warning I'd have with any of the other implementations is that there's very few eyeballs on those implementations.
Right.
So, one narrative right now is like, oh, core devs are corrupted, they're centralized power. But if you switch to Knot, that's literally one person. And like, I don't care, pick your favorite developer, whether it's Luke or GMax or Gloria or Peter, whoever it is, I wouldn't want to use software by any of them if they are the only people maintaining it.
Of course.
Even if they're like well-intentioned and earnest, the computer can be hacked and like the build can be corrupted unbeknownst to them, right? It's just crazy. So why run a full node? Like what is actually the point? Everyone in Bitcoin knows you're supposed to run a full node, right? But why run a full node? So the primary purpose to run a full node is for selfish reasons and not to help the network. The selfish reasons are when I receive Bitcoin, I want to validate it to make sure it's authentic Bitcoin and not counterfeit or fake. Secondly, privacy. Like I want to maintain my own privacy. If I'm using someone else's full node, I'm trusting that they are correctly telling me that the Bitcoin I received is authentic and they know my wallet then if they're running that node. That can, with BIP 157 and 158 compact block filters, that can help your privacy a lot. Let's talk about that a different time.
But the way I think about answering this, just to create like a stronger visual in my mind, the way I think about why to run a full node, it would be like, think about the gold analogy. Imagine you're a merchant and merchant at the farmer's market, and somebody walks up to you and they want to shave off some gold and hand it to you in exchange for your whatever fruit, whatever you're going to buy. Well, you would have to take that gold. You'd have to like assay it, make sure the purity of it, weigh it. You have to do all these things to verify that it is what it is while they're handing it to you and that it's not counterfeit. And so all of that assaying and verification is basically what a full node does. It's only when you're receiving the Bitcoin in exchange for something else you're giving, and you need to make sure that the thing you got, the Bitcoin, is what we're all considering Bitcoin and not some other thing.
Not devil's bit.
Actually, real quick, to follow up on that, I think I saw Bill Miller speak yesterday about for the U.S. government estimates to verify the gold they hold in Fort Knox would take, I forget what it was like 44,000 hours or just some outrageous amount of time and expense to verify that. And to your point, with Bitcoin software, you can do it in seconds. So
I think that's a really good analogy. A question I have, and I was kind of asking about this in a chat, and I think we did this in one of our December episodes last year as well, which touched on this, but what is a better metric? So instead of just saying, okay, there's X number of nodes running Bitcoin Core, is there a way to say like almost a weighted average Bitcoin Core nodes per UTXO? And specifically a follow-up on that, which I think is important, is a lot of people would have thought that in the block size wars of 2017, when you had all of the major exchanges and merchants like Coinbase, like BitPay, everyone went, for the big nodes, they still lost. So is that just because the people that had the most UTXO, the most value, they were the ones, the whales, so to speak, running full nodes that won in that first debate? Or how would you think about that?
Well, my quick answer to the last one is I don't think UASF or like the user nodes had, other than the, they had no impact on the network in terms of resolving that issue.
Okay.
Their loud voices mattered. But let's get into that.
It's like activism.
It's more activism. Yeah. And we covered that in the BCAP project, the Bitcoin consensus analysis. But we'll get into that in a few minutes. Let's see. What was the first thing?
Is there a weighted?
Oh yeah, the metric.
Yeah.
So, I'll answer that. But like, let me first. So again, I'm putting out there that the primary purpose to run a Bitcoin full node for selfish reasons to validate the coins you receive, keep your privacy. So there's no global metric that matters for that purpose. It's just an individual choice, really, right? But let's get into other other purposes, which I would say all of the ones I'm going to mention are much less important than that first one. But other reasons, one is to serve up blocks. So any new node in the network, it doesn't have any information, right? And one of the beauties of Bitcoin is that you can, from scratch, audit and verify everything. And well, how do you do that? You got to receive blocks. And this isn't a client server protocol. You don't just like connect to Google or the US government or something or Satoshi to get your blocks. It's a peer-to-peer network. You randomly get connected to like 8 different peers by default, and you can change that number. You can choose other peers if you want. They can all send you blocks. And all you need to be confident is that you only need to be connected to at least one honest peer. Even if the other 7 or the other N, like N minus 1, if they're all lying to you, as long as you have one honest peer, you know you're going to discover the blockchain with the most weight on it and the valid one.
Just a little aside, how do those 8 get determined? Like, are they randomized somehow, or is there some broadcast chatter that sort of helps you discover which 8 to begin with?
Yeah, there's a bunch of smart, good logic in it, but it does have a root of
randomness
of a fixed list of nodes.
Fixed. Okay.
Of like trusted people. That is part of it. But those set of trusted people, that's not who you connect to. Is you can look at I think they serve up a list of other peers or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But
I wonder if we might have some always on servers that could also potentially tell you which peers to connect to in the future.
But like an example of like a smart aspect to it is to protect against a Sybil attack where some surveillance company runs tens of thousands of nodes on AWS. So if it was purely random out of all the possible nodes, then obviously an attacker could make it so that, you know, 7 out of 8 or even 8 out of 8 of your randomly selected nodes are theirs. And then they could lie to you, they could log data on you, etc. So to combat against that, there's like IP address banks. And like you know this bank is AWS. Mm-hmm. So even if AWS has 3/4 of all the nodes, don't disproportionately randomly give people all AWS nodes.
You guys can read between the lines, I want to talk about this in a minute, but I'm wearing the Nostr shirt today because I actually think this Nostr will end up potentially solving this problem as well in the future, and as well as how torrents work. So we'll talk about the in-off protocol later, but I actually think we're going to solve that.
But back to the why run a node. Secondary reason, again, much less important than verifying your own coins, is that your node can serve up blocks to the rest to new nodes during the initial block download. And if no one's doing that, obviously then the network fails, because if you come online, no one's willing to serve you blocks. And so there does need to be a minimum threshold of nodes running in the network that are in quote listening mode, because there's two modes you might have heard before. Like you might hear different counts on how many nodes are in the network. And sometimes you might hear a number around 20,000, and other times maybe around 80,000. And it's like, are these just, and one is one inaccurate? Well, they're both estimates, but I think one is the lower number can like be actually measured. The other one is more of an estimate, but they're both valid metrics. The lower number is the number of nodes listening. And so when you run a node, you can configure it to listening or not. What does listening mean? It means that others can connect to your node, and that means you can serve it blocks. And so there has to be a minimum threshold of nodes in the network that are in listening mode that serve up blocks. I don't know what that threshold is, but I suspect we are like massively over that threshold. So we could lose a lot of the listening nodes and still be completely fine to service any new node coming online. Another purpose of running a node is to relay blocks and transactions just throughout the network. So if you send a transaction from your node and Max is the miner, you might go through my node and other people's nodes to get to Max, just basic networking. But I think this is where there's a bit of a fallacy where people think they're really helping the Bitcoin network by running a node to help relay transactions. Again, you need minimum connectivity so that the whole world's connected. But I think we are far beyond the minimum threshold needed. So like if we went from like 22,000 listening nodes to 15,000 listening nodes, I think that hurts Bitcoin not at all. And I don't know what that lower bound is, but it's probably on the order of like 1,000 or something like that. And this gets into relay policy as well. So when it comes to filters, which is one of the hot topics right now, like let's filter out the spam, the JPEGs, the naughty stuff, the stuff that isn't money. Let's filter it and get rid of it. But the reality is, number one, even if just like 10% of the network allows this through, like consensus valid transactions, 90% can be running this filter and it doesn't matter because it still makes its way to miners through the network. Secondly, it's already been demonstrated that you can go directly to a miner and pay them to get into the network. But just setting that aside, just using Bitcoin node software, using peer-to-peer, you only need about 10% of the nodes to support that relay and the filters don't matter. Another reason filters don't matter is it's whack-a-mole. Like if Bitcoin Core did try to like stop one type of filter, then before you know it, the people who want the JPEGs will find another wrinkle and another wrinkle. And ultimately it boils down to it's impossible to stop spam because the data that we all want in Bitcoin, transaction data, is just random data. So you can't distinguish between random data and people putting what looks like random data, but it's actually like pictures or whatever. I tweeted today saying I'm going to transfer my entire Google Photos collection into the blockchain.
Oh, wow. Fighting words.
Big fan of that. Anyway, relays of blocks and transactions. But again, there's actually a cost to the network by running a node, because every node that gets added marginally adds more hops to get from the sender to the miner, which slows things down. So I don't think most people realize that. It's minor, but it is actually, you're actually harming the network in a very minor way in that way. You're definitely not helping the network that much. Now, another, I would call it minor benefit, but someone just taught me this morning, is that even if you're running a node on AWS, as long as you're not keeping logs, there is a privacy benefit to other users, because the more honest nodes in the network that you transact through that aren't keeping logs, you gain privacy-wise. But I mean, let's take the other extreme example. Let's say every node that you connect to and that gets from you to the miner was all run by Chain Analysis or something, and they're keeping logs. They would have more information about you and your transaction than if it was really well distributed and no logs taken. So, I would call that a minor benefit. So I call that a minor benefit. I'd say the added hops is a minor negative. Right. I think that's in the wash. Serving up IBD blocks, that's definitely needed, but you only need a minimum threshold. So again, the primary purpose is to validate your own coins and privacy. And a thing I'd say about this, to date, the primary use case of Bitcoin has been hodling. You buy Bitcoin, you hold it, and the number goes up and you increase your wealth. Right. That's been the primary use case. There's also another use case, which is peer-to-peer money, which is the title of the white paper. A lot of people are working on that to make it a currency, make Bitcoin everyday money. We all care about that. Spiral cares about that. Many people care about that. But that's not been the predominant use case. Now, in the future, when it is, the more merchants there are, small businesses that are accepting Bitcoin as money, they absolutely should be running their own full node, because they can't, they'll need the automated approach that you mentioned earlier, David, to validate the coins they're receiving. If all you are is a hodler, let's say you bought Bitcoin on Coinbase 10 years ago, and then like a few years later, you're like, oh, I need to self-custody. So you transferred it to like a Trezor or Ledger. Like, you don't need to be running a full node right now. You're not transacting Bitcoin. It's just sitting there in cold storage. It doesn't matter if you're a whale and you have 100,000 Bitcoin. You running a node in AWS or in your laptop, or you bought a Raspberry Pi, literally doesn't help you at all. And you're not any more powerful in the network just because you're a whale by running that node. It literally has no benefit. The power you have as a whale is if you sell. That's where you exert your power, and that's near ultimate power. But if you got 100,000 Bitcoin and there's like a, if there's a consensus conflict and like you got to pick fork A or B, if you dump B and you double down on A, then your voice is very loud and you have tremendous power. But you running Bitcoin Core each and every day while you're sitting, your coins are in cold storage, literally has no power and is of no consequence.
And so, when you say you get power, you sort of demonstrate your power when you spend, or when I think you said sell, but that has nothing to do with really your full node and exercising the power of your full node when you're in a sell or spend process. That's only when you're in a receive, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Because even like, let's say someone has 100,000 Bitcoin, they don't like, they want to sell because they don't like the direction of something. They can use someone else's full node to send their coins to Coinbase or Kraken and sell them. The only reason they need to run their own full node is if somehow whoever they're relying on trusting to send the transaction just says no.
Right.
There's not really any reason for them to say no, but if for whatever reason they're saying no, well, then you can run your own full node and send your transaction.
That's really clear to me now. I think it's important. Whales demonstrate their power by dumping the bad fork or the fork that they choose not.
We're just getting out of Bitcoin, saying like, this is not what I signed up. This is,
that makes
sense. Against the investment thesis I had, I'm out.
Yeah. I want to come back though, because I think this is interesting to me. So we were talking about the different implementations with Knots. Could you come back again and compare what's the difference between running Bitcoin Core and Knots versus LND, LDK, C Lightning,
known
implementations?
Yeah.
Is there one or?
Yeah. So, you know, in Lightning, there's four major implementations. Mm-hmm. There's pros and cons to that. I mean, an obvious con is like duplicative effort.
Yeah.
Each of the four projects has very talented developers on it. And imagine if all those developers were just working on one Lightning implementation. That's a lot more brain power and productivity that you can focus on one project. So that's definitely a drawback to having so many implementations. Having said that, having the multiple implementations, you can sort of, each project has optimized for different things. Mm-hmm. And each project is thriving in one way or the other as well. So it's unlike Bitcoin, in which one project is dominating. Like if you looked at economic node, to answer your question about metric, I don't know what the number is, but like a good metric would be like, what's the percentage of economic nodes on the Bitcoin network are running each implementation? And I guarantee you, if you looked at economic nodes,
it's probably 99%.
It's 99%+ running Bitcoin Core and not. So this market share increase of Knots going from 1 or 2% or whatever it was to 7 or 8%, I guarantee you, is like hobbyists, enthusiasts, people who are advocating their discontent with the Bitcoin Core project.
But they're not merchants or miners, probably. I mean, there might be some, but
yeah, I don't think businesses have switched because of this. No.
Sorry, as a quick follow-up on that, is there a way to actually query and get that data?
There's not, because you can query like the nodes of the network, what version they're running.
Right.
But it doesn't also come along with, I'm an economic node, or like, here's how much Bitcoin I've received in the past 24 hours. So you don't know.
Yeah.
The other side of the privacy is you can't tell.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, I'm wondering if there's like some way you could get a better guess. But
I think, well, here, I mean, so
you could just ask people. That's one.
Right. So, I mean, this is a bit dated, but in 2018, 2019, as part of Bitcoin OpTech work, I went out and spoke with like 50 different businesses, all the exchanges in the space, and learned about their infrastructure. They all ran Bitcoin Core, and they all had their own wallet too. They didn't use Bitcoin Core's wallet. They used Bitcoin Core for the peer-to-peer code, the consensus code, to validate the coins they received. But their actual wallet was their own. They just built their own wallet internally. But they all ran Bitcoin Core. No one ran an alternative implementation. And so I'm just projecting that to today, 6 or 7 years in the future.
Yeah.
I just highly doubt if you're like Ryan Armstrong or Jack Dorsey, that you're not like switching from core to nots because of the operturn relay policy. It just makes no sense to me. Mm-hmm. Because that's a completely ideological argument and has nothing to do with running these businesses. So I feel quite confident it's 99% plus running Bitcoin Core for economic nodes.
Beautiful. Yeah.
The only one I'm not quite sure of is miners. I have heard some miners run knots, and that seems plausible to me.
But wouldn't they make more money if they get the quote unquote spam?
Well, that's a new thing. Prior to knots filtering out high fee paying transactions, I believe it's the case, and I don't know this for a fact, but I believe knots, like I said earlier, made some changes on Core that miners wanted.
Yeah.
And if that's true, it wouldn't surprise me if miners then ran knots because they asked for a feature and they got it, right?
Right.
So I don't know the facts there, but it's plausible to me that some or many miners run knots. But I'd love to, hear more from, and when I say miners, sadly, I mean mining pools, which are not that many.
Right.
Because miners today don't get to select transactions.
Which is the topic of a deep dive on a future show. So,
but yeah, so I think the signaling preference is the main value of not increasing market share. Mm-hmm. And I'm not dismissing that value. Even though, I have my own opinions on the past, on this relay policy in the past week and a half, I feel very strongly on one side of it. I really like people's passion and people care so much about Bitcoin. I mentioned that last week too. I think it's a sign of health actually for Bitcoin, even though it's like kind of a nightmare and wasting people's time. But if we had to do this every week or every year we work on Bitcoin, that would not be fun. But if these kind of things coming up every once in a while, I think it's a sign of health.
Yeah.
People care. And it also like raises, I guarantee you there's far more people who are reading about these nitty gritty details of relay policy today than before, because they want to know what all the hubbub's about. So it actually does increase awareness of like technical details of Bitcoin and policy details. So I think that's a good thing. And so not gaining market share is a signal of like, hey, I'm really pissed off and I'm running the software. I took the time and energy to run the software. So I think there's value to that.
Yeah.
Boom. I know there's a lot to cover. We have other topics we want to get to, and we're already kind of well into it. Do we have anything else in knots that we want to summarize or final comments on that?
No, that's good.
Well, one thing, as we're talking about payments, I did see Steak and Shake has claimed publicly on Twitter that I think they're accepting payments. They didn't mention anything about Lightning. They said Bitcoin payments, but that could be Lightning. Seems like it would have to be, as far as I understand. But Steve, I think you reached out to your inside contact at Big Burger. He's checking right now.
The Big Burger Industrial Complex.
First I'm going to retweet our show because I forgot to do that.
Been to a Steak and Shake?
I don't even know what that is.
Okay, I've actually been to a Steak and Shake.
I DM'd Steak and Shake and they haven't replied to me.
Oh, Big Shake is busy.
Yeah.
it's kind of like an In-N-Out. I went to one of these back in the day in Urbana-Champaign, where I went to school. They had a Steak and Shake, and it's kind of like an In-N-Out. All of the Steak and Shakes that were in California appear to have closed. Many of the ones in the Midwest appear to have closed. So it's kind of like a South and East Coast phenomenon, but it's kind of feels a lot like an In-N-Out.
Yeah.
And there's 500,000 followers on Twitter, and they claim, come use Bitcoin here. So that would be kind of an exciting...
Well, they claim 100 million customers. They've been around for 91 years.
Yeah.
So...
I would love to hear more about the story. Like, are they serious? What made them decide to do this?
Is it start with a Bitcoin treasury?
Demand or ideology?
My guess is there's probably some, like with everything, orange-pilled person within the company.
Yeah.
The CEO, maybe.
Yeah, I'm also curious. Back in like 2014, there's a wave of like, oh, Bitcoin's going to be used for everyday money. And we saw similar thing, like certain like e-commerce or even physical stores accepted money. I mean, Square accepted money or, Bitcoin at the time.
So did Stripe.
And obviously that didn't go anywhere. And now we are 10 plus years later, but it could be another wave of that. It's just not there yet. Especially for the use case of like Americans who aren't being censored today there's not a censorship problem trying to pay at Steak and Shake.
Yeah. Right?
So is there really a value proposition?
I don't know, man. I hear those burgers are they're illegal.
Yeah. Is there really a value proposition for Bitcoin for that type of payment? We'll see. cutting out, so historically it's typically a marketing exercise to do this. We'll see if there's actual adoption. But the good news is today versus 10 years ago, the usability of spending wallets on mobile phones is much, much better. Obviously, way more people own Bitcoin now. So the probability of the masses now own Bitcoin, and it's relatively easy for them to take a small portion of that stack and put it in a spending wallet on their phone, and it's pretty usable. So that's very different today than 10 years ago.
Totally.
So, and as we talked about last week, the US government might be changing the tax laws. Mm-hmm. So all these things are coming together where it's credible that it could be used in these situations. I'm still a little skeptical on that type of transaction.
Yep.
Because like me personally, I would just go there, use Apple Pay. I get 2.5% cash back on my credit card. Like, that's hard to beat.
Totally.
And
I think if you think about the way my mental model for this is very simple. And I think you hit the nail on the head with the first piece, which is Bitcoin first found product market fit, just HODL. Okay, that's obvious. Then the next market that actually made money was exchange. I think the next one is securitization. That's what we're seeing with MicroStrategy and other companies that are doing that now. Payments, I think, will probably come after that. Now, the sort of elephant in the room, which will be a nice transition point into more of the sci-fi stuff, is maybe something like AI using Bitcoin payments will make it go explode even faster. But I also don't think it's like completely sequential. It's not 1, 2, 3, 4. It's like a little bit of one bleeds 10% into two. And over time, it's like, well, that becomes 20% into two. So I think, you know, as we've discussed, and I think two shows ago, we had a lot of discussion on Bitcoin Lightning payments taking off. Like, it is happening. It is headed in the right direction. Maybe there'll be an inflection point. My guess is, you know, if you're crazy like us and the whole economy comes to Bitcoin, it's going over $10 million a coin. Once it's well over $10 million a coin, Bitcoin payments are like, that's the norm. Somewhere between there, let's see, 2025 and 2035, or whenever that actually ends up happening, it's going to be, you know, my guess is a series of moves in that direction. So, beautiful.
Cool. All right. So, confidential sci-fi. Compute?
Yeah. Well, okay. So, confidential compute, yes.
Is that
so,
not sci-fi?
I have a couple of things. So, I definitely want to talk about confidential compute. I have a lot to say about this. We may even need to go into a whole other episode because this is like one of the deepest, most beautiful rabbit holes. But I have to start with what's hot for me because I think it ties a little bit into that. So, obviously, the base protocol of Bitcoin is what matters most, Lightning on top of that for payments. What's getting me so excited right now, though, is thinking, okay, assuming now we have money that works, and it obviously always needs more work, and payments that work. What can you then start to do that? And that's the reason I've always been so passionate about stuff like Nostr and now confidential compute. Because if you want, you know, the sovereign individual, you want the Kevin Kelly, you want the Buckminster Fuller visions to come to fruition, you need all of these different elements to layer on top. It's like Bitcoin's the money, Lightning is the payments. Now, what do we do with the identity piece? What do we do with the data piece? How can we build the new web? What does it actually look like? And so the first thing I just want to mention, because it's so hot on my head, is this is the, I would say, most exciting week I've seen in Nostr ever, which I know sounds a little hyperbolic because, you know, you and I had a whole show just on Nostr. We've been tracking this closely for years. But one thing that I just want to remind people with Nostr is, you know, it's a public private key identity system. So your identity is a pub key, signed everything with a private key. Interestingly, it's a Bitcoin key and we haven't even explored that yet. And then you obviously transmit messages over relays or a free market of servers and have Bitcoin and Lightning payments easily integrated with all of that. Great. Those are the fundamentals. I think for many years, it's been a very slow roll. People have seen other quote unquote decentralized networks like Mastodon, like Blue Sky, which are, you know, Mastodon has other issues. Blue Sky is not really decentralized. It's more of like an Ethereum decentralized and name only kind of thing. But my thesis has always been the features that work elsewhere and other good ideas, just like with, you know, features that come from the Ethereum or DeFi world will always come back to Bitcoin at higher levels of abstraction, which we're seeing with things like lending, which we'll also discuss. Same thing's going to happen in Nostr. And so, you know, it's been a slow roll, but in the last 1 to 2 weeks, I've started to see the fruit being born from all of the seeds we've been planting for many years. So one example, Kali launched the ability to finally do your own starter packs, which is a great idea that came from Blue Sky. So mm-hmm. Now if you're onboarding someone, you did this in the very hood way at the very beginning. You just said, hey, follow these 10 people. Great. But now anyone can create their own, you know, like I've seen, okay, here are people that are in Indonesia. Here are people on Nostr that, you know, here's merchants. And so for the circular economy thing, which someone visited the Presidio Bitcoin, we talked a lot about circular economy. Maybe you only need 10 or 12 merchants to be able to actually completely unplug from the traditional economic system if you want.
Help me understand. I saw the post about the pact, but how is this different and more meaningful than just a list of like 10 accounts to follow?
I think it's just easier for people to onboard, user experience. Same idea though. So, you know, hey, I just want to, with one click, add all these people into people that I'm following and see them in different kinds of clients. But yes, it effectively just is a list, but the list, obviously you had to actually go and follow one by one.
Okay. And is it being added to the Nostra protocol so any client can adopt it?
I don't even think it required a NIP to do this, but I'm not sure. That's something we can check in with Callie. But that's one very small example. The bigger examples that I'm super excited about, and I think a very interesting trend that I'm seeing is, you know, you've got the hackers that come up with these amazing ideas. Then slowly, we don't have a ton of like full businesses in there, but you start to see the businesses sort of commercialized or productized. Okay. Blossom servers. Holy fucking hell. This is a big deal. So we've talked about Blossom servers for over 2 years now. Blossom servers are, you can think of as, you know, I think this was said tongue in cheek, but it's true. Nostra devs accidentally creating a better IPFS, which is the interplanetary file storage system. That's something very interesting. If you're, you know, interested in decentralized storage, you can go read all about that. But Fiat Jaffe wrote a really nice piece back in 2020 before creating Nostra, explaining all of the issues that he had with IPFS. The central issue was, you know, this is what made me think of when you were talking about the finding your peer nodes. They have these, what do you call them, like hash tables? I forget the name they use for them. It's essentially a hash table where you have to store, you know, this person or this node is storing this data. The point is, if you try and store everything in the world in that, it bloats too quickly and you're trying to store all of that on your computer. And so what's beautiful with Blossom, which came from two Nostra developers in Madeira 2 years ago, Stu Bauman and Hazard149, is they basically figured out you can use the core concept from IPFS of a hashed file. So if I say this is a file that I want to be able to find on the network, I publish a hash of it. That's genius, because now I can know exactly this is the untampered video or this is the untampered photo or whatever it is, non-text file, because Nostra only shares text, obviously, on the relays. But then they added to that the ability for you in a Nostra client to publish which Blossom server you're publishing to and mirror to as many different Blossom servers as you want. And so now that's very beautiful because you use the identity piece of Nostra, which is already there. And you know, I guess they implemented a NIP to be able to signal which Blossom servers they're publishing to. But now Primal has taken this really cool concept and commercialized it. And you can already live in Primal, go ahead, upload a video or a photo. And in the past where you were just using something like Nostra.bill, which was just like a wrapper on AWS, and like, God bless someone mm-hmm. willing to take on that risk. Now you can, in Primal, choose which Blossom server. So maybe you start with Primal's Blossom server, but I'm going to mirror to three or four different other ones. And that hash is stored. So anyone on the network, you know, even if Primal goes down, my client goes down, their server goes down, the Nostra relay or the Blossom server, you can still go out there and find that file on a mirrored Blossom server.
And so in a given Nostra message or post, it'll have this hash, and it also points to every mirror that I chose
yes.
to store the photo or whatever media it is. And then a client, the way the protocol works, a client just starts in order and tries to look it up at the first one. And if it somehow is not available, then it just moves down the list.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure exactly how that works, but my assumption is it would look for the primary Blossom server first, and then that Blossom server, I'm not sure if it would be the client or that Blossom server that points to the mirrors, but one of those, or maybe both, would point to the mirrors if it can't find it there. And what's cool about that is you could say, hey, I'm posting something to, you know, my AWS Blossom server, which 99% of the time is awesome. And in the 1% of the time, it's content that they actually took down. Then you could use the decentralized backup. So you could get the benefits of cloud storage, the price, the convenience with the quote unquote censorship resistance of Blossom.
And what about, so, because there's a cost factor too. Like the reason I wouldn't want a zillion mirrors is because I had to pay for every one of them, right? So I might start off with just, I only host my media at AWS because right. it's the cheapest. I don't have to pay for others. Then let's say I come across that 1% of my content that does get censored or it's against their policy or whatever. I guess I'd learn that right away because I posted that. I'd see that it didn't go through. People would complain, or I'd see that, and then I could redo the post to point to another Blossom server. I'm just trying to think through, like, in reality, what would I do when I encounter, or I'm a controversial figure who I'm not, it's not 1% of my content, but it's a high percentage. Or AWS has banned me. Right, you know, I only posted one thing they didn't like, but then they banned me, and then all of my future content can't be hosted on AWS.
Or your past.
Or past.
Like, so, if yeah. your, so I guess, your archive, or, thank maybe. You.
So that's getting my question. Yeah. Then, so can I, so I might have thousands of posts that are now invalid because they only pointed to AWS. They've banned me, so they won't serve it anymore. Can I then retroactively, I guess I can't modify those posts because you can't edit a Nostr post. So
what you might be able to do is...
So it's more like if you're controversial, if you think you're at risk of censorship, you really do a priori need to have mirrors.
Or to be clear, you know, not just if you're at risk of censorship, but you might say, hey, and by the way, the other piece that's missing all this is IPFS. The thing that's missing all this is also incentives, right? And IPFS, you know, part of their solution to trying to solve this was Filecoin. And or I think they had the Filecoin one, which of course raised a ton of money and then nothing, as with all the altcoins. But in this world, I expect to see the next iteration is going to be Lightning payments for this, right? So you could say, okay, you know, maybe there is like a very long tail of content that almost never gets accessed. But what you can start doing is you could either, some people maybe store it just to whatever altruism, but like you can also, okay, I'm going to pay for certain people to store. So maybe the long tail storage is incredibly cheap. And something that Stu discussed with me even 2 years ago, which I think is going to happen, is you can have bounties for content. Like you could say, I know this is a file. It's like very rarely accessed, but it's at the edge of the network. You know, maybe it's some like ancient text that I want to be able to see. And I'm going to include a bounty, which is I'll pay this much for it. You know, see how long it takes to get the file. But you could keep upping the bounty until someone's like, all right, now I'm going to go find this hash for you and really hunt through the network to see where it's stored. All of this to say, there's a lot with Blossom, but I think the bigger takeaway for me is these are just two examples. There's a lot of other stuff that shipped in Nostr this week, but once you have the decentralized identity system, and then once you have relays critically, not just for transmitting all the data, and I think that's something that people get wrong about Nostr. It's not like I'm saying move all of the web to Nostr. That's crazy. But once you have the ability for these message boards to find, you know, other either peers or servers that are hosting other kinds of content, you can rebuild everything on the web, but at different layers. Another idea that came out that I'm just super, super bullish on, I'm going to go much deeper on, is NoAuth. So there's this guy, Tim Bouma, who's doing some really, really cool stuff. He's, you know, building alternatives to Signal on Nostr, a bunch of other cool stuff. But in doing that, and this is also the beautiful thing about what's all happening in the Nostr ecosystem right now, it's all accidental innovation. It's not like they came out and said, I want to solve IPFS. It's okay, we can only store text notes on Nostr. Well, shit, how are we going to store video or photos? And then they built this as a complement to what they were building, right? To solve a real problem. Similarly, in trying to build his, I guess, encrypted chat app, and I think he also has like a Dropbox that's encrypted too, so storage app, he ended up building what he's now calling NoAuth, which is OAuth, but on Nostr. And so in the way that, for the listeners who aren't familiar, OAuth is like what basically everyone uses, like Google, Facebook, a few other big guys, maybe X, Apple, they run OAuth servers, which allow you, whenever you click on a website and say, log in with Google, log in with Apple, that's what you're doing, is you're hitting their server. But of course, they're controlling it. It's completely centralized. His point is you can now negotiate for every site or every peer-to-peer transaction. You can use a Nostr relay if you both agree to it. And you can peer-to-peer send basically messages back and forth to agree what kinds of permissions you want to give to a specific user for your site. So the possibilities, once you have these like building blocks in place, it's wild. Like literally it is watching a truly decentralized web, and it is so fucking cool.
I still have some critique on Blossom. Do we want to go there, or sure. Do you want to get the confidential compute?
I know we're short on time this week. So,
I mean, my only, I'll post, or I'll say what I'm thinking, and then we can talk about it later if you want. But, I generally like it, but I do worry the fact that you sort of have to priori choose your mirrors, that you're still at risk of, like, you know, months or years in the future you wind up on the naughty list, and the mirrors you chose historically all consider you naughty and all ban you, and then you don't have access to your content. Not only do others can't see it, but you don't have access to your content anymore, and the only way to protect yourself against that is to host it yourself. Which is certainly an option, but like, then that's a different, then you don't need, you don't need Blossom or Mirrors if you're hosting it yourself. You just have it yourself.
Well, I think the hosting yourself will actually be a really nice transition to the confidential compute. The only thing I would say to that is, you know, again, this is like version like 0.1. You could also envision services like this is where Primal allows you to choose your mirrors. So it's just like a simple example, but you don't have to. You could just say, hey, I'm going to pay Primal and my premium subscription. It's not even like whatever. I'm not even paying per megabyte or whatever. I mean, that could be an option too, but I pay, you know,
it's 10 a bundle 20, or something.
Yeah, yeah, it's a bundle. And part of Primal's promise to me is they're going to figure out the mirroring so that it's not going to go down.
Yeah. Or even you could have like a DNS entry that is just a pointer.
Exactly.
So all your posts. So if you that you're then trusting that your DNS enter, it could be even your own DNS. Yeah. So here's, I think, a better solution.
We're here to fix Blossom.
It's much more manageable to like control your own DNS entry versus like all of your media. And if you control that one entry, it can be a pointer. And then you can, while you can't edit your Nostr posts, all of them point to your DNS entry. That's the hard coded part. And then you point the DNS entry to whatever server that's currently willing to host your content.
And that DNS entry could eventually be on Bitcoin.
Now you still run the risk of like whoever you're choosing to host your content, if you lose access to them, then you've lost access to your content. But often it might be the case where they don't serve it to others, but they don't take it from you. So in that scenario, then you're protected. Okay. All right, I'm reasonably satisfied with this.
Okay.
DK, I know you thought about this. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I I've talked to people about it a bit. I think that Blossom is a really great solution for a piece of media that you suspect would be taken down and you want to be sure that it gets replicated and mirrored many places so that it is resilient to censorship. I think for kind of every post to go into lots of places is very expensive. So you kind of have to have like, what's the model for who's going to host the mirrors, you know, who's going to pay for that? And I think the stuff that Primal is doing is great in terms of how they bundle it and make it very simple. So I think that's like a great solution today. But I'm not sure that I want to have like 5 or 10 copies of like random photos I take of like, you know, the outdoor beautiful scenery. When it's not really going to be censored anyways, versus if I'm like, oh, I have a really controversial view on, I don't know, knots or something, and I want to write it, and I think like, you know, whoever I'm hosting it with is going to censor me, or at least has potential for that, then I want to get it out to 10 or 20 different places with different ideologies behind them so that I can be pretty sure that it doesn't get censored. I'm like excited that we have a solution to this, but I think we should really be intentional about where we apply it so that we're applying it in places that are, where it's really useful and kind of worth the cost.
Well, and I think to steal a quote, and hopefully this won't be too controversial, but from Cali, when talking about the Bitcoin core debate, which is, quote, fees are the filter, I generally agree with that. And I think that's the case for this too. Like incentive, like we're laying the economic infrastructure, but like what people are willing to pay for is going to solve that problem.
I have never retweeted Cali more than in the past week.
Dude,
he's been on fire.
I was on fucking fire. We haven't even talked about multi-path payments that's happening on Cashew, which is the ability to have multiple, this is its own rabbit hole, and we'll do this in a future episode, but multiple Cashew mints, which are like private banks, you can now do a giant payment for it if you want to do a $100 payment from 100 different mints put together. We talked about this months ago. We talked about it on the show. It's live. It's working now. And oh, by the way, it's all tied into Nostr. You can literally store the Cashew in your pub key. It's crazy. My biggest takeaway from all of this is if you think Nostr is just social media, you are absolutely asleep at the wheel. We are rebuilding payment services, storage, everything on the internet, and then new things. I haven't been this excited in a long time, and it's really cool.
Cool. Was there one thing you mentioned that your mind was so blown this week? Is it kind of the culmination of all the stuff that you saw, or was there one thing that really drove that moment of surprise? Like, was it the no auth thing or the
Blossom stuff? I think no auth is the biggest one. Okay. I think it's all of them just hitting at once, just back to back to back. We didn't talk about Will and Domus. I think he shipped, I haven't played with it yet, so I can't say much, but the first version of his notebook, there was the Nostr vibe coding thing from Soapbox, making it much easier with their MCP server to get all the NIPs and like orders, libraries, things you need to actually vibe code with Nostr. Maybe that'll be useful. I think you said this, Steve, for the hackathon. But I think that all of it hitting together at once, if I had to pick one though, it's the in-off protocol. And the reason I say that is, like, if you think about centralization points on the web, and not just for like the extreme censorship, but just like, again, it's always like the frog boiling. It's like the internet was open and wild and free, and then like all the users went to five websites, and those five websites are now running OAuth servers, which allow you to log into anything else on the web. So basically the web is not very useful if you don't have accounts with Facebook or Google or Apple or Twitter, whatever it is. And now with this possibility to negotiate between two individual users and a user in a site using a third party, like a truly decentralized relay, that to me has implications that are massive.
Yep.
Absolutely massive. And it's just like, we're just showing the demo of this today.
We got half an hour. I know we want to cover Strike launching Bitcoin loans and confidential commute or commute.
Both.
Which do we want to tackle first?
DK?
Why don't we do a little bit of Strike in the new launch there, and then we can do confidential compute at the end. So I raised this because I've obviously been like very interested and active trying to play with Lava and understand sort of how this sort of Bitcoin collateralized lending and loaning future is going to work. So it's an area that I've spent a lot of time kind of leaning in on Lava. And then recently, I think it was a week or two ago, Coinbase launched a loans product, or kind of scaled up the loans product and made it more kind of professional. And then Strike this week announced that they have a loans product. Lava is scaling up their loans product. And I was also just looking at, there's, you know, a bunch of others over the years, like I think Salt, Ledin.
Unchained as well.
Unchained has one.
And EatFi.
Yeah, BlockFi. Yeah.
Celsius.
Storage.
Yeah, RIP.
Okay, we're getting into the dregs now.
12-year prison sentence.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think this is like a really important, you know, I think about everything as like these bridges. I love the fully ideological hold and spend in that. I think it needs to exist. There's a place for it. But I think to make bridges to the existing systems and where meet people where they are, I think these loans products can be helpful at meeting people where they are and understanding kind of value they can get from Bitcoin today. So I'm spending a lot of time on these, but everything with these, it's all trade-offs. And so I wanted to talk through the trade-offs because like we've said, I think a lot of people don't touch the trade-offs. They say, you got to do all of this thing, or this is my best advice. And I think our best advice is usually, well, try to understand your use case, try to analyze the upsides and the downsides. There's not one right answer for every person or for every use case. And so I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the trade-offs across like this portfolio of offerings that are currently available and what kinds of things we would like to see come out to improve them in the future.
And before we jump into the trade-offs, I think maybe giving a little bit of context on Bitcoin lending, and I want to just share, you know, and I've got personal experience. I was literally using the products this week, and it's we're getting there.
Early days.
It's early days. We're getting there. But, you know, I also have mixed feelings on this. And for those who don't know, I'm sure most people don't understand at this point. The idea of Bitcoin-backed lending is, you know, you take Bitcoin, you then over-collateralize it, usually in a 2-to-1 ratio or something like that, and you get a US dollar loan against it, which you can use to buy your coffee because people love coffee and Bitcoin, and pay your rent, things like that. And I think there's a massive market for it. BlockFi, others have demonstrated that before they blew up. But I do just want to say there's a part of me that's like, I have mixed feelings on it. Because yes, there's a huge market. Yes, it's going to be useful. Yes, I need it myself. And yet part of me is a little bit like, I have mixed feelings because the whole system is structured in such a way that those that have access to assets understand how the system works, basically collateralized lending in the first place. It's been, I don't want to say exactly a scam, but it's like, if you understand how the system works and you own capital assets, this is a way basically to stay rich and have tax avoidance. And that's what people use it for. It is what it is. But it's very sanctioned. That's what people use, you know, real estate loans, all kinds of things. Part of me is like sad that you have to be such an expert in any of these things to, and I guess that's part of the beauty of Bitcoin is it's so simple. I save in Bitcoin. I don't have to be, you know, a hedge fund manager to beat inflation. Similarly, I wish there was a world where, I mean, I guess this gets to the Jack point of no state is the best state. You know, if people could just transact freely, that would be beautiful. But in absence of that, at least with Bitcoin collateralized lending, you know, Bitcoin as a capital asset is open to all, and collateralized lending is open to all. So at least it levels the playing field.
I'd push back a little bit. I don't think you have to be rich to use this, and yeah. I don't think you have to be super sophisticated either. Again, we already said it's early days, so I don't think any of us are saying Russia, everyone should be using all these products right now. It's early days. There's even more risks today using them, but in the future it'll mature. But the reason why I say you don't have to be, you know, rich, like, let's say, I mean, obviously it's very relative to what is rich, but even if you have a modest amount of Bitcoin and that's your savings, your life savings, you can still use it as collateral for a loan. And if you need to make a payment this week and it's urgent and you don't get your next paycheck or you don't get your next flow of income for a month or 3 months, that loan really matters to you. And it doesn't have to be $1 million loan.
No, it can be
literally like a $50 loan, right?
I agree with you 100%. What I was saying is the more prior to Bitcoin, right? Like the reason we have asset-backed lending in the first place is so if I'm super wealthy and I own a house or whatever, a vineyard in France, I'm saying I agree with you. This is democratizing access to that. I'm just saying it's kind of silly that like, I don't know, like that you have to play this game in the first place, but...
The only way to get out of that game, though, is to be on a fully Bitcoin standard, which I think we can all believe that's the future, but it's not probably next year.
The reason this is a strong value proposition is taxes, too. So, there's multiple reasons you want to keep your Bitcoin, but one is if you have a low cost basis, and it, again, whether you're rich or if you have a modest amount of Bitcoin or a lot of Bitcoin, either way, if you have a low cost basis, you're not excited about selling it and having to pay a massive tax
bill. I think Max is saying you should.
100%. Yeah. So
I'm just saying it's sad that like.
Sad that you have to know about taxes. All
this like tricky stuff in the front. Yeah. And we're democratizing.
What tricky stuff do you need to know?
I'm just saying like in the past.
Lava is super easy to use. The main thing I'd want to make sure people understand is that there are risks you're taking when you're taking out a loan. Even with Lava, like Lava is by far the most secure architecture, but there's still some risk, liquidation risk, and you don't want to lose your Bitcoin through liquidation. So you do need to be savvy enough to understand that risk. And then let's talk about some of the trade-offs in different products because I think having these different options is good. You're going to find products with different rates that you have to pay and different like counterparty risk, and you do want to understand what deal you're signing up for when you take out a loan.
Yeah. Right. So let's jump through some of the possibilities.
Real quick. let's talk a really quick about use cases as well. I mean, you mentioned buying coffee. I don't think that's, I mean, you said that in jest, I think, but
yeah, it's true.
The reason it's been a big market historically, BlockFi and all these companies that like went bankrupt and basically lost everyone's money, you know, why were people taking out the loans? The vast majority were, they wanted leverage. They had Bitcoin, then they used it as collateral to get dollars to buy more Bitcoin or to buy shit coins and play that game. So it was like levered buying and just taking on more risk with a bet that the bull run's going to continue. That's, I think, been the predominant use case so far. But in the future, I mean, that's going to continue to be a major use case. But I think we're going to see other use cases emerge, such as your own personal example, which I don't know how much you want to talk about, but you know, just in general, people who need a short-term loan to make a payment and they don't have the cash flow.
Didn't even buy that Picasso he had his eye on?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if Max wants to talk about why he needs cash quickly, but
I'll let you say it.
But anyway, it's fully legal. Max's use case is fully legal.
Thanks.
Insert jurisdiction.
But yeah, I mean, so like taking out a loan to buy a coffee, I don't think it's like the use case. It's more like you've got an imminent bill or a need or a desire right now, and you know you're going to have the cash flow in the future, and it might be months away or years away or whatever. I mean, sort of the typical reasons people buy loans, those use cases will emerge.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's get into the different products and what the trade-offs are.
Yeah.
Okay, so what if we start, I think we talked about the Coinbase one. Did we talk about that last week? Or?
And by
we
the
should
way,
at least summarize it.
Yeah, because you dropped some word I had never heard, which sounds horrifying, like Morpheus or something. So.
Morpho?
Morpheus.
Is it?
Morpho, yeah.
So okay, let's just like highlight a few of the key features. We can sort of talk through them and you can check my knowledge on it because I don't have this like extremely detailed chart in my head, but... my understanding is in the Coinbase case, you're depositing your Bitcoin into Coinbase. They're going to act as your custodian. They take your Bitcoin, they wrap it in some form of like a wrapped Bitcoin, CB, BTC, I think.
Yeah.
They then take that coin out to an exchange or a DeFi exchange, DeFi protocol called Morpho.
Morpho.
And then... on Morpho, there's liquidity. The lenders are coming from Morpho and they're sort of bidding on what they want for loan terms, and then that's the one that gets passed along and brokered back to you by Coinbase. Is that roughly the structure?
I'm not a Morpho expert, but what you just said is my matches my understanding.
Yeah. And so a lot of what you want to think about are like, what are the risks that you are taking on when you deposit your Bitcoin into Coinbase to do this kind of a loan?
And very high level, even without getting to the specific products, right? Like the dynamics. If I give you the keys to my Bitcoin and you give it to someone else that's willing to pay for that and you pass on, you know, some of that, well, there's an interest rate that's set on that. The fundamental question I would always ask, there's always two fundamental questions I would ask for any of these products. Who holds the keys to your Bitcoin? Are they rehypothecating it or not? You should be able to answer that question very easily. And then the second thing is, who are they giving it to and what the hell are they doing with it? And this Morpho thing, I have no idea what they're doing with it. Just the name alone and the DeFi thing tells me there's some degen shit happening. And like, I certainly hope, by the way, Coinbase has these Bitcoin-backed loans separated from the custodian stuff they do. I'm sure they do. I certainly hope they do, because if not, that could be a giant blow up. But
so as far as the risks with Coinbase, I mean, there's two we should highlight. One I'd call a small risk in the short term, and that's the fact that the CBBTC, like Coinbase's wrapped Bitcoin, that Bitcoin, it's in their cold storage. It's relatively safe. The risk of that being lost in the short term is low. Long term, we've talked about on past shows, they've become a huge honeypot. And even though they have like really strong security measures, like that's risky. But the big short term risk is Morpho. And I'm not an expert on Morpho, but my understanding, and this has been confirmed by people that I've spoken to at Coinbase, like the rate you get for your loan is variable, and because it's in the shitcoin land, like there's a lot of volatility, and that rate can fluctuate dramatically. So if it spikes extraordinarily high on you and you're unable to make a payment, I believe it introduces a new liquidation risk. Mm. So one that's independent of the price of Bitcoin. Like the price of Bitcoin is the liquidation risk you're going to face in any loan where you're using your Bitcoin as collateral. If the Bitcoin price collapses, all of a sudden your collateral is worth a lot less, and the lender is going to want to see more collateral, right? That's a risk you're always going to face with that type of loan. But this is an additional risk where things that are not the Bitcoin price and completely outside your control, the rate increases, and then if you don't make your payment, you might lose your Bitcoin. So that really, to me, feels like I don't know enough about the probability of that rate increasing and by what magnitude. So knowing that would inform me better, but it feels like a product I wouldn't want to use.
Yeah, I think
solely for that reason.
Because it's through Morpho, I think that means they're sort of somewhat blind to who's on the other side. DeFi would claim we're totally blind, which means you don't have like a really high quality lending partner who's providing liquidity, stable capital source, pre-negotiated terms. You just have like, leave it to the market. Whatever people want to lend at is fine, which sounds like a nice free market capitalism kind of, you know, libertarian bent. But we know that the characteristic of that kind of capital is that when liquidity dries up, let's say, you know, NASDAQ goes way down or other types of risk-related assets goes down, a lot of times liquidity will dry up, which means now there's fewer lenders, means rates spike. And so my understanding on the terms are, you know, you get a 50% loan to value to initiate, and you have to maintain, I think, 86% loan to value on the Coinbase thing. So if you ended up, let's, you know, simple example, deposit a Bitcoin, about 100K, you get 50K of USD back, and you owe whatever's the stated rate of like 12% or something. I forget what it is. It's less, is it? Is it 7%?
I think it's 5-7%.
Okay.
5-7 is for Llama. I think some other ones are higher.
I've been poking around, but it's somewhere in that rate. It's 5, 7, 8, 10%. And you have to keep that 100K loan to value below $86,000 then. But that if suddenly the interest rate spikes, you could start accruing a lot more to that 50K of loan that you're taking. That could start growing very, very quickly.
And again, to hammer the point you're saying, for any of these products, to me, the key question is transparency. What are those
What's happening?
Doing with the Bitcoin? Like, if you can't, like, this, by the way, you know, when I was looking at DeFi very closely at my last fund for a year and a half, I sincerely tried to understand, where is the yield coming? And I could not answer that question, at which point I said, I'm the yield.
Yeah.
And so if you can't answer, like, explain it like I'm five.
Where's the yield coming from?
Who takes Bitcoin? What do they do with the Bitcoin? If you can't answer that question, run, is my advice.
I agree.
Yeah. And that's a thing that I think is the longer you study Bitcoin, the more that you understand that the transparency and the trust minimization is like a core piece of why the whole thing works. And almost every system we have in the world, governments, corporations, clubs, whatever, always have some amount of non-transparency that gets exploited by whoever's in charge. It always happens. Even if you're probably in charge of a system like this, maybe your HOA or something, or like you ask the garbage guy to come by and pick up your thing before everybody else's, because wink, wink, nudge, nudge, I'm the guy who makes the decision, right? Like these things, it's just like anytime there's a chance for like non-transparency, you get some form of minor corruption, like full stop. It just happens. So when you don't know where is the yield coming from, who is lending, what are the rules, if you can't verify that, that's when you should start to be very, very scared. And that's why I'm scared of the Coinbase solution to this.
So let's talk about Strike a little bit.
Should we give Coinbase the props on what are the benefits? What are the pros? We should see, are there pros?
Easy to use.
Well, I mean, we should fact check what the rates are, but I thought they were in the 5-7% range.
So good rates.
So maybe assuming that's true, then it's much better than what Strike just announced.
Yeah.
And it's competitive with Lava.
Yeah.
And I don't know this for a fact, but I would suspect there's a lot more liquidity with Coinbase than with Lava.
Yeah.
So at this point.
Yeah.
So the probability of me actually getting the amount of loan and maybe the duration at a reasonable rate is probably much higher. So I don't know that for a fact. That's probably true. And if it is true, that would be the benefit. And then, like I said, it's a relatively small risk you're taking about them host or controlling your Bitcoin. It's the Morpho risk, which I think is a big unknown.
Yep. And I think they do loans up to $1 million or $1 million.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I think if you deposit up to $2 million of collateral and get $1 million of cash out.
Yeah.
So easy to use, probably good rates, and you can get large loans.
Which I think is new, because I think it used to be 100K max. So I think they just recently bumped that up.
So Strike.
Strike announced a similar type of product in spirit. My understanding is it's actually a larger cap. I think it's a $2 million cap on the size of the loan. I think it's a 50% loan to value. So, I think that's sort of standard. But I think they're working directly with liquidity providers and partners. So they work with partners who provide liquidity. They're stable capital sources. They have pre-negotiated terms, I assume.
Like NYDIG.
NYDIG.
That was mentioned, but I think Jack said multiple, and that was the one that was dropped. So we don't know the other ones.
And there's some questions around rehypothecation. Just to clarify, rehypothecation is once it gets into the hands of the lender, which is how these things always go, what does the lender do with it? And, in the scammiest of situations, the lender lends it out in some super risky thing that generates a good yield until it doesn't. So I think with NYDIG, and I don't know them personally, but my understanding is they're one of the kind of good actors in the space, that if they're the custodian or they're the lender, they're probably not doing super degen crazy stuff, but I don't know if that's for sure. Steve's keeping it very blank.
But I know of no reason to say that statement's not true.
Okay.
But I would have said, the only reason for pause, I would have said the same thing about Genesis.
Uh-huh.
Right. And a lot of our mutual friends lent Bitcoin to Genesis. One's very vocal on like the ex-Googler Bitcoin list.
Right.
I think a lot of people would have said Genesis also wouldn't do play those shenanigans, and they did.
So, very basic question. Again, they're probably, I have no reason to believe they're a bad actor. Of the actors, they're probably the best actor, although we don't know for anyone for sure. For someone that is a good actor, what is an example of something they could use that Bitcoin for that's low risk today?
Can find treasures?
I think it's a leading question.
I don't know. I'm serious.
You can deploy it on the Lightning Network.
But we're not getting real yield there yet. That can change soon. Absent Lightning Network.
I think yield is the, you can't deploy a lot of capital yet. Or I mean, if you deploy a lot of capital, your yield goes down.
So let's assume we're deploying a lot of capital.
Yep.
Can you give one example, just one, of a way you can get yield without a lot of risk?
U.S. Treasuries.
I'm not trying to be whatever. I'm just saying if you can't answer that question very well, but because
but even that doesn't make sense to me. Because you're holding Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well,
so your liability is in Bitcoin.
Right. But they might have some hedging.
If there's people listening that can give us examples in the chat, please do. I'm being very honest. Like in the future, this Lightning Node thing is the one thing I can think of where it makes sense. If I give you Bitcoin and I trust you're a good actor, like, you know, a Block or a River, and like, I really think you know what the hell you're doing with your node. Okay. Probably your hot wallet risk is relatively low. I'm willing to take that risk. I don't have any other examples yet. Someone else did.
And the reason why that's a special category is because you already trusted that entity to give them your Bitcoin, and they're not giving your Bitcoin to someone else.
Yes.
So you're not taking additional counterparty risk of the Bitcoin.
And again, like left side of the curve, I understand there's risk. The risk that I see in that is you're running a hot wallet, you could get hacked. So then the question is, do I trust Block or do I trust River to like run a Lightning node successfully and not get hacked? Cool. I know exactly what risk I'm taking.
Yeah.
I haven't studied the options markets around this, but I bet you could generate yield.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. Or like collared, you know, you could probably create yield where you say, I'm willing to give up the upside in exchange for yield. There's probably some way to express that idea. And I think that would be how you would generate it in a not super scammy way.
Okay.
So not crazy risky way, but I don't know if this market's
one thing we didn't talk about with Coinbase is rehypothecation risk. So I think their stated policy in legal terms is that they don't rehypothecate the wrapped Bitcoin. It would be good to fact check that.
But my understanding is they put it into like the Morpho protocol, and then
they put the wrapped Bitcoin. They put the token. They don't. They hold the Bitcoin.
Okay.
Decentralization wrapped Bitcoin.
Right. So
Stevie BTC, I thought it was operating on Base, and I thought it somehow got its way over to.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, but to get unwrapped, it would have to get
token.
But then they have to trust that Coinbase.
Will unwrap it and give it back. So the Bitcoin is actually living at Coinbase in that case. Interesting.
Now with Strike, I think Jack Mallers did tweet and confirm that they like can rehypothecate. They may with some partners, but not others,
right,
or something like that.
I thought I saw something like that.
Yeah. So that's
not a great answer.
It's honest. It's transparent. Yeah. You asked for transparency. So yeah, it's not a great answer in terms of like when you're deciding to use this product or not, you need to add that risk factor to the profile. It's a little surprising to me that it's 12% rate and rehypothecation. Like in general, if you're taking on that additional risk, you'd expect a lower rate. So, I guess we'll talk about Lava in a second. But like,
yeah,
I
was going
to add like 5 to 7% and provably no rehypothecation and provably no counterparty risk. You're not giving up your Bitcoin. That seems like a way better deal.
Yeah. So, but would you actually pay more for the no rehypothecation? So, like, what about 7% with rehypothecation, 13% with no rehypothecation. What do you pick?
No rehypothecation for me. I mean, obviously the numbers that you have to like, it also depends on how long I'm doing it for. If I'm only doing it for 3 months, I'll absolutely pay to make sure my stuff doesn't get jacked.
I'm paying 13% no rehypothecation.
Yeah, you have to pay more because you're the yield.
I'd want to, I mean, that's a big enough delta. I would want to dig deeper, right? So, who are their partners? Getting back to Max's strong point, which I totally agree with where you start with, is like, what's happening with that Bitcoin? Who are they lending it to and for what purpose? And if I don't get an answer, or if I learn that it's like degen trading or whatever, I'm paying 13% or just not doing it. I wouldn't take the 7%. If it was if the purpose of the additional loan like actually made sense to me and didn't feel like total degeneracy, then and it was a more of a trusted brand and partner with a track record, then I'd probably take the 7% and the rehypothecation risk.
Yep.
Now, once they blow up, we'll come back and check it on your answer.
Another, I think I shared this tweet. Another one that I thought like this was too good a point to just skip while thinking about collateralized lending is I forget who it was that made this. Was it Bitpain or Bitstein or somebody? Is that
Bitpain's
a Bitpain? Okay, I don't know who's who. Is that a real person we know, or is that a pseudonym?
I only know the NIM.
Okay, so but he made the point that instead of messing with all these other things, go to the TradFi system, buy a Bitcoin ETF, and then get whoever Robinhood or whoever you're using as like a brokerage to give you a 5.5%. Collateralized loan on your Bitcoin ETF, which actually is kind of like a better answer right now than a lot of these alternatives.
Yeah.
What are the benefits? Well, one, the rate is attractive. Two, you're not taking rehypothecation risk because the Bitcoin ETF, like it's in the terms that they won't do that.
Yep.
And three, like the institutions involved that could screw you are huge. Like trust. Well, what do you mean by huge? I mean, like I don't think like it's a risk of
fail, maybe.
Oh yeah, that's okay. Right. I mean, I don't think BlackRock's gonna like single you out and try to take your money or like rug you or whatever. So there's a lot of attractive aspects to it. But let's see what are the it's arguably the best option today. Except the problem is, if you have your Bitcoin at Coinbase or Cash App or self custody or basically not in an ETF.
Yeah.
Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to sell it? I mean, one point of getting the major point of getting the loan is you don't want to sell your Bitcoin.
Right.
But to get into the ETF, you have to sell your Bitcoin to then rebuy the ETF. And then once you have the ETF, and if you want to self custody again, then you have to sell it again. So you're paying capital gains multiple times.
Yeah.
So that's a huge reason not to do it today. But if you already have your Bitcoin in an ETF, or you're starting from scratch and you're buying Bitcoin, then I think it's an attractive option.
And I think this brings up a couple of interesting points. One, Saylor's been hitting this hard, not just for ETFs, but also MicroStrategy. Another reason we're pouring into MicroStrategy is because you can actually tap, your traditional margin lenders on equities in addition.
I would point, so I just said it's, I just want to be clear, even though it's an attractive option, if you are starting from scratch and you buy the ETF, but everyone should be aware that right, if you buy into ETF, if you ever want to self-custody, it's a tax trap right now.
Great.
Because you have to sell, pay taxes to then rebuy and self-custody. So we all need to be paying attention to the in-kind transfers, which can operate in two directions, where you can get Bitcoin out of an ETF or put Bitcoin into an ETF tax-free. And there's, those are, right now, neither is possible. It could be the case that one of those is enabled or both.
Is there an active discussion? Have we heard anything more about an active discussion about that?
I don't have an update on that. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there might be an update, but I don't know the update. Yeah. But, each has benefits. If for the case of like, I already self-custody Bitcoin, I want to take out a Bitcoin-backed loan and take advantage of what you just said, David, well, then I want the in-kind transfer into the ETF because I don't have to pay taxes. But then it's like Hotel California,
right,
and you can't get it out, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I really hope that we see in-kind transfers bi-directionally.
Yep.
I think that's good for everyone and accessible to everyone, not just like large investors or institutions or whatever, but in-kind for retail would be best for everyone because then lots of people can start with the ETF. It's accessible. It's a great way to start with Bitcoin, but you're not in this tax trap. And then once you value self-custodying or using your Bitcoin, spending it, and then you can do that. You can take out some from your ETF and spend it, or go in reverse if you want to use the ETF as collateral for a loan.
And we talked a little bit on our bike ride, but I don't remember if we talked about it on the show, and I don't know if we got to the end of it, but there was an announcement from Schwab that they want to do spot crypto trading in the next 12 months. I think they were primarily Bitcoin. But if they are doing that, and we know that the authorized participants like Jane Street have been approved for in-kind redemptions, I think both in-kind to and from, you could imagine that sort of we're laying the foundation of the pieces that could enable that bridge to get from the ETF to the authorized participants out to retail, like that may be coming together. There's like at least indications. I don't know if we have any certainty on
that. And if like Fidelity does that too, I mean, you start getting big, powerful companies lobbying for that change as well. Because the fear I have is like, if it's a large entity like a BlackRock who wants to maximize AUM, they're not going to be, if that's the only factor, they're not going to be enthusiastic to push for regulation that allows in-kind withdrawals because they want to retain their AUM. But if you have large, powerful players that also make money when it gets withdrawn and it's an exchange, all of a sudden, I think that seems way more realistic.
And this seems like a critical policy point. I don't know if Bitcoin Policy Institute or other people are pushing on this yet, but actually maybe like one of the single most important things I've ever heard is the ability to redeem in kind if you want Bitcoin to like survive as a meaning exchange in the future. Like that seems like, other than after getting the minimum tax exemption, maybe like the next most important thing.
Yeah.
But I just want to make two points because I think are very important here. So to your point, this is a point Saylor's made. I think you're making a very, you know, a good one. If you're already going to do custodial loans and you're going to hand over your Bitcoin to someone else to do whatever they do with it and give you a rate of return, assuming you could get in and out either way, like you would be silly not to do the ETF or MicroStrategy type version because you're going to get much better rates, much deeper liquidity, more traditional institutions, way less Wild West. Like it just seems like a better deal all around, which I think leads to the importance of two other things. One, we get Bitcoin for payments ASAP because this is clearly what's going to happen. It's like you would, of course, you're going to use like have your money in ETFs because why wouldn't like the incentives are all aligned for you to do that. So I think that's why like getting medium of exchange for AI and stuff like that, like it's pretty much we're in a very important, I would say. You know, on the one hand, people are going to be celebrating because they're going to get rich as number grow up. Great. But on the other hand, like this is the time where capture can happen. Like if you don't quickly realize there's a reason to keep the money outside of the system, it's all going to get sucked in. That's the danger. The second thing, which we haven't mentioned at all, and I know we've been wanting to talk about, is Lava. And even in a world where, you know, ETF or MicroStrategy margin lending is the best option for most people, there's still a world for something like Lava. And Lava, which is, you know, disclosure, I think we're all invested in or you know, work with or whatever. But Lava is something I'm very excited about because the principle is you can take Bitcoin, you can provably lock it up and reference a discrete law contract or DLC that will have a price oracle that says, okay, you know, we can do the 50% loan to value ratio. Once it reaches a certain amount, you get liquidated, all the same, you know, parameters, obviously with different numbers that you might get in traditional centralized lending. But the key is you never give up the keys to that Bitcoin. You always have the key. And that to me, like this to me is like the biggest innovation in Bitcoin lending. If this works, this gives you a massive incentive to keep your coins outside of the system. And I will say, as a guinea pig, I made my first two Lava loans this week. I got them to work. Full disclosure, there were some challenges because I have an iPhone SE and
You were depositing Bitcoin and borrowing USD.
Yeah. And these are small loans. So like I would say everyone like inch your way there. The team was awesome though in helping me get the bug squashed. We got it fixed. I told Shazan like his hiring is superb. The dudes that helped me through this were awesome. To be clear though, help was still required, but we're getting better every day. But I got it to work and I ended up with, you know, small loans, but transferred to my bank account. And I still hold the keys to the loan itself. It's pretty sweet. To me, this is the future.
Yep. So you off-ramped bank dollars. And then what is the term, 30 days, 90 days?
I think I did one. I was experimenting with different ones. And we're talking like very small loans here, right? But 90 days and 30 days.
And you plan to just kind of wire or ACH bank dollars back into Lava and then they'll deposit into the contract?
That's right.
Because I think we had a chat that said you can actually use cows for redemption. Do you know how that works?
Excuse me.
You can use cows.
I flippantly said cows. But that's I mean, there's still.
You got a ranch, Steve?
Farmers from Iowa. Yeah.
Well, I would. Exactly. I mean, either before or after stating cows, I asked if I could use Trump coin to pay back my debt. And he said, Shazan said yes. That's still some homework for me to understand this. I feel like I understand the DLC smart contracts really well. I think my knowledge of the USD Solana side of that is weaker. He's saying that, so here was my understanding, which might be a little bit flawed, but so I want to take out, let's say I take out a loan, like let's say Max is the lender. So Max has USDC Solana.
Trust me, bro.
So he gives me USDC Solana. And then that's the smart contract's written in a way that it's like atomic. Like I receive that money, but at the same time, he gets all the guarantees that like that I have my Bitcoin collateral locked in this smart contract. If I don't repay properly, he gets the collateral, etc. So that's all atomic. That's all good. It's all transparent. Literally in the Bitcoin blockchain, you can go look, not spam. But where my knowledge is perhaps deficient, I assumed that means when I pay the loan back, I mean, there's two ways. There's the happy path is that I pay back the USDC Solana that he lent me, and then I get all my collateral back. That's the happy path. The unhappy path is I don't repay on time or deficiently or whatever. Then the smart contract's written in a way that some of my Bitcoin is given to Max as the repayment, whatever's needed to match the repayment. What Shazan is saying is that I don't have to repay in USD Solana. I can repay in like any token on Solana.
But it has to be a Solana token.
I think because it needs to be, you know, compatible with like HLC Solana. Like that's part of the
smart contract. They do some atomic swaps, get it back. Yeah. Into
so I mean I kind of understand what he's talking about, yeah. But like I don't fully understand it, so I need to learn more about that. But that's, I mean, I was joking about like he's saying you can repay in anything, so I'm like, oh, can I repay with a cow? So but
he said yes to the cow. No, because there's no cow on
he
Solana.
Was flippantly responding to my flippant comment, but anyway, I hope he's that's a bit of a detail, yeah. But I mean why use Lava over BlackRock and Robinhood or that solution? Well, number one, no KYC, and number two, no privacy.
Well, so we should be clear on that. Like, taking a step back, they pay you out. First of all, there's a lot of things to figure out. Those in Lava USD, that's a question exactly what Lava USD is, and like it's their own stablecoin. You could also get it in USDC on Solana. To be clear, I don't have any SOL. I don't want any SOL. I don't want to touch the Solana blockchain. So for me, I want it all just transferred to my bank. If you want to do that, then you do have to KYC.
But if you do not have to KYC to take out the loan, get the stablecoin dollars,
true.
Transfer it to like Phantom wallet, and then switch to, you know, trade any coin you want, including wrapped Bitcoin or something.
Yeah.
Or you can transfer it to another exchange and buy more Bitcoin.
Right.
So I can take my Bitcoin, take out a loan in Lava, no KYC, get the stablecoin, transfer that, buy more Bitcoin. Collect more Bitcoin and just keep doing that and getting more and more, accumulating more Bitcoin, no KYC. So it's only if I go to a TradFi bank like Wells Fargo or something do I have to KYC. And then privacy as well. So the no KYC matters. I mean, a lot of people around the world they don't have a Schwab account. They don't have they can't buy BlackRock ETF. So for tons of people around the world who, it's not like some kind of like shady deal. They just literally can't KYC. Lava will be a great product for them. So getting back to the sort of the democratization point, you don't have to be, you know, a privileged person like American with a bunch of money or whatever with your own personal BlackRock account. You can just be anyone in the world. Even if you've got like a few $100 of Bitcoin, you can take out a loan with Lava. And even though you had customer support and it was a big hassle, and it should not be minimized. All this stuff is early, but I mean, my experimentation with Lava, I've also done experimental loans. I would also double what Max said and like start slowly with the stuff, but I did it in like one click and it just instantly got the loan. It was like an incredible experience. The only getting the loan was instant. The only delay was like the 10-minute block confirmation on Bitcoin. And like in some future version of Lava, it'll support Lightning and then it'll literally be instant.
That's sick.
It's like amazing.
It is
like,
magic. Yeah.
And then another future version of Lava, something we've all pushed on hard, and finally Shazan says it's on the roadmap. We should keep pushing it.
Keep pushing.
Is that you can bring your own custody.
Bring your own custody.
Because today you have to transfer your Bitcoin to the Lava mobile phone app, like a single SIG wallet, which I'm sure is like relatively secure, but like that's for at least three reasons. The product needs to support bring your own custody. One, security wise, everyone has their own personal preference for custody. Let them choose what that is and not have to switch it. Number two, UX. Even if I'm comfortable with the Lava app on my phone for security reasons, it's still a pain to have to transfer it from my wallet to that wallet. And there's a third reason too, I forgot. But anyway, the third reason is like co-marketing. Like all the other custody solutions would probably be more than happy to partner with Lava.
Yeah.
Because if you're like Casa, for example, like, this is great. Like, if Casa wants to retain AUM in their product because they make subscription money off their service, right? So if their customers have to transfer the funds out of their system into Lava to get a loan, that's bad for them.
Yep.
They want to keep the funds. So they'd be more than happy to partner with Lava and market and co-market with Lava because the funds stay within Casa. So I think with those two improvements to the product, it'll be a huge win. A third improvement is around Oracle. So I've been going back and forth with people on Twitter about, oh, there's no difference between a multi-sig and DLCs, and there's no difference between like having like Unchained or Coinbase control your Bitcoin versus a DLC, and that's just not true. It reduces risk tremendously, but you can still strengthen the Oracle's situation, the risk you're taking there, by having multiple Oracles, and those Oracles being big brands like River, Coinbase, Block, etc., Strike. Having multiple of them, and like any one brand doesn't want to like tarnish their brand by lying or cheating the price of Bitcoin and with their signing Oracle, right? So we'll evolve to the, I mean, we the industry evolve to that. I expect Lava to evolve to that, and that'll be a very robust solution.
And I also want to, I mean, those are all incredible points. I hope Shazana is listening to this. Like, Steve is so right. Also, the exchanges, a lot of the exchanges, local ones I work with, they're getting demand for loans. They would love to co-market and build this as well. There's so many. Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity. I'm very bullish. One thing I also just want to hammer on, I know this was kind of implied, but I don't think you said explicitly, so I just want to say it. You mentioned all the reasons someone might use Lava. There's the privacy piece. There's the people outside the United States, which was a great point. I wasn't thinking about that, so good one. But also, even if you are okay KYC, the other main reason you would want to do this is you want your stuff outside the system because you don't trust any of these entities because you used BlockFi and you KYC'd and it was great, and then they blew up. And every single one is blown up. Genesis, 3 Arrows Capital. So for me, the core value proposition for someone in the US, even if they are going to use a traditional banking system, is you can see on the blockchain where your Bitcoin is and no one can take it and rehypothecate. That to me is, that's the core value.
Yep. Well, we didn't get to
confidential.
We rug pulled our audience.
Sorry.
Lots of great discussion, and we'll definitely get to
it. Yeah. Next time.
And a small plug. I just dropped an episode you guys can check on my iPod, Ideas from the Edge, in preparation for what we'll talk about next week, where I talk with the guys from Open Secret all about confidential compute. So if you really
for nearly 2 hours. So you can go listen to that.
Did you listen to it?
I started, and then, I mean, it's going to be like on my drive commute, so it'll take many drives.
Modern, thank you. So if you really need that hit of confidential compute before next week, check it out.
And final, before we close, are we still accepting applications for Presidio Bitcoin Hackathon?
We are. In fact, perhaps someone Max just had on his show.
Maybe coming to hack?
Be coming. And just applied. So yes. We still have a few slots. I think we're around 40 approved hackers, and we've got a few slots left. So if you're still interested in just learning about it or just ready to decide, please still apply.
And it's pbhackathon.com.
Yep. And we're Bitcoin. 1 week away, though, so now is the time.
Now's the
next
time.
Week, Bitcoin plus AI is going to be sick. We've got some incredibly strong people coming from places like Berkeley. I've seen people from the Nostr community talking about it. Like, honestly, this is going to be, like, I think when we look back at the history of like AI using Bitcoin, maybe this is where it all starts.
Isn't it like $10,000 or $15,000 worth of prizes?
There's some cash money.
Yeah, over $10,000.
Over $10,000, yeah.
Yep.
It's like big money.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we will see you at the hackathon.
It'll be delivered as Bitcoin, though.
Of course. We'll see. We'll actually be doing our next show just hours before the hackathon starts. So this is our last time to mention it. So
yep, glad we got that. Thanks for bringing that up.
Okay. PBHackathon.com.
PBHackathon.com. All right. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Till next time.